This is a presentation on parity inclusion representation and its use in HIV prevention, community planning, and other uses around that for health disparities. This is over a decade of work Kathleen and I have done with the HIV Prevention Planning Council in San Francisco and other work with community planning groups and other coalition bodies working with health disparities. I have no disclosures to admit to, except to say that I'm a little concerned with our profession's need to disclose these types of things as we enter into the same realms as the political and financial worlds. So I'm going to talk today about the purpose and process of HIV prevention community planning in the United States as it is directed under the CDC. Do an introduction to the ideas of parity, inclusion, and representation, which are the guiding forces behind community planning. And give an idea of some of the process evaluation tools we've used with San Francisco's planning body over the last 12 years, I believe, we were at. So the purpose of prevention community planning, if you look back about 12 to 14 years ago, most funding was done on a categorical basis, not very community-centered. And there was a realization that that wasn't going to work very well, given the various degrees of difference between all of our communities. So the CDC really started to look at stopping the AIDS and HIV epidemics through evidence-based planning, community-appropriate, community-relevant for individual localities, for it to be effective, so that what you're proposing is actually effective for your community and your area, and that it be guided in local action, that it wouldn't just be this program is for now, but that it would progress, and that communities would be deeply involved in ending the epidemics in their areas. This was established in 1993 nationwide. The six major epicenters in the United States were directly funded and have their own bodies. Each state has a community planning body, and then each county within each state has a community planning body. San Francisco is somewhat unique in that we are a city and county and one of the six epicenter cities. The process then is that the CDC provides guidance and funds that are required for the community planning process every year, and that includes that they be participatory, local, and public. These can't be behind closed doors, which was something new at that time as well. And that, as I mentioned, community planning working groups be set up in whatever jurisdiction you found yourself in, that they be comprised of people that were both infected and affected by HIV. This was important. One, because it acknowledged that people with HIV might actually have something to give to the planning for prevention, and that in most of our communities, there are many people affected, whether it be the individual, the family, the community, caregivers. It pretty much goes down the line. And again, that it be evidence-based, and that each jurisdiction was required and is annually required in many cases to do a gap analysis of services and programs, and that you start compiling and start acknowledging best strategies and interventions. Specific to HIV prevention community planning is a product. Each jurisdiction has to provide a prevention plan. It's generally done about every 4 years. There's some leeway in how long they can be. The bodies are advisory to the departments of public health. So unlike Care Council, Ryan White funds, they don't have financial authority or any that level. It is advisory on what the community expects departments to do. And the power comes in a letter of concurrence, which is required every year with each application from that jurisdiction to the CDC funds. And it basically says, yes, that we agree with the way the Department of Public Health is going to progress with these, or no, we don't. And in that case, there's a lot of work done. In San Francisco, we've never had a letter of non-concurrence, but we have had a letter of concurrence with grave concerns in the early days. And there was a lot of work to make sure that it was rectified. What this looks like is that really the power of this new way of looking was in the process, that it really is getting the diversity of all the people, including researchers, community workers, and those infected and affected at the table, and that you're working on something tangible and that you can really take to your communities, and that's important. And it's a required partnership, so no longer would it be health departments saying, this is how we're going to spend the dollars in your community, that letter of concurrence really says, we will spend it the way you tell us to. And again, it's a local focus. It's not a, that's the, sort of the trickle-down effect going from jurisdiction to jurisdiction down to the local body. And again, they all in prevention community planning for HIV, there is a letter of concurrence which looks back and ahead because it takes into account the history of that community and the really needs of it. There also is a requirement that it be chaired by co-chairs. One, a governmental representative, which is a DPH in usually Department of Public Health or a State Department of Public Health higher up, and a community representative. In San Francisco, since we like to push things a little farther, we actually have two community co-chairs to the one DPH co-chair. They all have an equal vote. You can see a little tipping of the scale there. Also, the CDC required, and this was a really important step, required process evaluation of the entire process. Not just once every 3 years we're going to come in and do a nice little survey and see what we can get, but ongoing for every jurisdiction. Decided how you want to do it, but really to look at the process, that it, what we put into the mix is going to depend what we get out of it. Again, a required part of the planning process, it can be anywhere from 20 to 5% of the budget in San Francisco throughout the years. It's, again, continuous, and the evaluator in the way we've done it is both an observer and often serves as a coach for the leadership who may be able to benefit from an outside perspective of what's going on. It also looks to bring out and encourage the multiple perspectives that you'll hear that are at the table. And the CPG is underlying, so process evaluation underlying, it makes certain that you're following the guidelines of parity, inclusion, and representation that the CDC has required to be in the process. What is parity, inclusion, and representation? Or if you're another type, it's inclusion, parity, and representation. Parity, everyone has the same vote. No one person or one block can have the power. Inclusion means that the process you go through really includes all. There are no backdoor meetings. There are no closed-door sessions. There are no alliances that are hidden until the last moment. And representation, that the membership really truly reflect the community and, again, those infected and affected. This can sometimes be a little tricky with evidence-based planning, because if you're in somewhere like San Francisco where more than 90% of new infections continue to be in gay men, it has been a process where communities have had to acknowledge it's okay to have other people that don't fit into the epi profiles, because we may not know the entire story, number one, through epi profiles. It's our best step, but there are some hidden nuances there. And communities are fluid. We know this, that people cross over. We may not always admit to it, but we cross over. So process evaluation and addressing disparities, we really, again, look to draw the attention to what you're working towards. Is what you're doing actually getting towards your goal? Has an emphasis on group dynamics as they impact the planning process and the movement that gets there. It really can be, if you do it continuously, a good way of picking up on challenges, picking up on successes, and picking up on those dynamics that are often sort of scuttled under the table in the rush to get something done. And we like to look at, again, a range and flexibility in how you do it, the style of your community, the style of your evaluators, whether that be coaching, facilitating with people how things are done, exploring and reflecting the analysis that come out of a lot of the paperwork. For any of us who are involved in HIV prevention and community planning, the number of documents and the number of pieces to analyze can be daunting and overwhelming. And it's a sensitive way of looking for those large and small moments of inclusion and exclusion that prior to this process really had some led to some difficulties in making sure prevention was appropriate for communities. So we're going to look at three levels of process observation that we would like to say are appropriate for all types of health disparities, working towards health disparities, whether it be towards 2010 goals or 2020 goals, or looking at ending other health disparities that have been so guiding the process of our work. So we're going to, since we all flew in, most of us flew in here, and I'm about to fly out of here, we're going to look at sort of a flying analogy, looking at three ways of doing this. 30,000 feet, if you think you're in an airplane, you look out the window at 30,000 feet, you don't see much. You see the broad plain. You don't see the nooks and crannies of life. You don't see the valleys. So what you're looking at, this would be looking at a meeting in general, or the process in general. And on the left side are what we have used with the Prevention Planning Council, looking at broad indicators, process landmarks. You see little variation because, again, you're looking down out the window at 30,000 feet. You're not going to get those intricacies. It's often predictable because if we look at long-range relative frequencies, they often sort of pan out, and we're not looking at individual specifics. You can expect stability in your numbers because, again, this is a broad look. You might notice some dips, but they're not going to be huge. Some of the things we ask then, just basic, really easy questions. Were these engaging presentations? So if you're having presentations and everybody's falling asleep, something's going to change there, or you're going to have a bunch of somnambulists. Are the materials you're giving out and forcing people to read and expecting people to read, are they helpful? Much of the paperwork we found was just not helpful. And there's overload when you're dealing with individuals who not only have their work life or have their personal life and then spend at least 10 to 20 hours a week in a community setting and a community board making intense decisions. If it's not helpful, don't burden them. All of us who have talked too long, was there adequate time for discussions and questions? Anybody who's been through one of these sessions knows there usually isn't, and that's a real problem. Why be around the table if you don't have time to discuss and speak with each other? What you can find over time are new norms and new indicators that might be more appropriate for your meeting, but these are always sort of a good start. So these are just some more examples. Was there participation from all members of the council? I was able to participate as I wanted. I was able to participate. Many times we are able to participate, but it's the way somebody else wants us to, not how we would like to. Were my opinions valued by the council? We found this has been really important, especially in conflicts or other dynamics where people may be expressing their communities needs, their community's desires and hopes, but if nobody's listening, that gets around quickly. And was this important to HIV prevention in San Francisco? It's always nice to drive home, whether it's HIV prevention, other disparities, community work. Is this important to what we're doing? Well, if we're at the table for this cause and we're not talking about this cause, we should be at another table or we shouldn't be talking about it. So we're going to descend a little, and hopefully it's not rocky. So 15,000 feet, if you're in the airplane, you start seeing a little bit more of the topography. So these would be looking at daily agendas or meeting agendas, but specifically for each item. So it's no longer looking at the grand scope, but this item, how well did we do? It's more specific. Again, it's variable because you're going to have different items, and if you're tracking items over time, you're still going to see some change. Looks at component parts so you don't throw out, as my partner would say, the baby with the bathwater. Some pieces of your discussions may be relevant, some may not, but to look at individual pieces rather than throwing out an entire thought or an entire process because one was bad wouldn't be good. And we often do that in our rush to move on. This way helps you sort of look at the whole picture. And you're developing a collective knowledge of process and process evaluation within your own group. So for each item, these are, again, simple things. You can do them on 1 to 5, 1 to 7, however big a Likert you want to do. I understood the information. If people didn't understand what they were talking about after 3 hours, then there's a big problem there, either in how we're addressing or how we're intaking. Again, were the materials helpful? Was there adequate time for that specific agenda item? And was there full participation? And this is a tough one because many people think that it's often okay to become a rather important part of a policy body, sit there, and never say anything. That's not a really good full participation. People's voices, people's participation is needed and wanted, and that's what we're looking for. Again, just some other things you could look at. I was ready to vote. Votes are often rushed on people. We want to know if they were ready, and if not, I support the decisions we made. This is often a good one if you're rushed into a vote and or if there's a lot of pressure to vote a certain way. It's in these individual evaluations or individual glances that you can tease out of people, okay, maybe I wasn't, but I felt like I had to. And that's something we need to stay away from, those relationships. And it gives, an emerging process commentary on the process you're in. at 5,000 feet, right before you hit the tarmac, you really do get to see a lot more about individual, really specific data and feelings about meetings and whether or not PIR was reflected by questions. And this is my favorite, three words to describe your experience of today's meeting. People often tease us because we use the simple little tool at the beginning of any evaluation, three words. And people think that's silly. How often are you able to just give three? In fact, three words. What's the session been like? Come on, you can do it. Three words. Give me one. Interesting.
Pretty darn good.
Terrible. Now, occasionally you get these, and you know, that's an important thing. Somebody thought it was terrible. I'll meet you afterwards. So, somebody thought it was terrible. Why was it terrible? It's important to know that one person thought it was terrible. You may have 50 people saying it was great. One person thought it was terrible, and that's a really important kernel. And is there anything else you'd like to say? We rush through decision-making. We rush through community importance. We give a lot of lip service to, yes, we want to hear from you. We want to end disparities in our communities, but we don't have time to hear the rest. And it's often that last piece that wasn't able to be covered because of time limits and agendas that is so important. Some of these things, you see micro moments of inclusion and exclusion. Again, those times when I don't feel like I'm able to be myself or to represent my community in this process because of. You get a feeling of what parity, inclusion, and representation really feels like. It's easy to walk. It's really difficult to do. Feelings become data. What we've been telling groups for a long time is those three words are data. Many people don't think of words as data. Every piece, every moment of that meeting, every feeling, every thought, every action is data. Don't ever throw your data away either. We have 12 years of data with this process. We're running out of space in our closets, but it's important. It's important to keep. And that you must honor that data, whatever you find, whether it's joyful, whether it's painful, but in an evidence-based process, you have to honor those pieces. So just here are some of the words you might see in a three words: exciting, rushed, participatory, hot, pensive. You get things like BJ uses the masculine pronoun. Please be aware, in a group of many people, we often use the he. And if you're in a group that's 50% more women, which we all live in, that might be something to think about. And Kathy made me keep this one up. Kevin, you're all that in a bag of chips. For those of you who ever had an experience with me, rarely do we see those kind of comments. So these are all ways of knowing and naming to make sure that all voices in the process are heard, from private to public, from the margins to the center. If you're going to have that table and you're going to invite people, hear them. They become data again, and that data must be honored. An evidence-based, locally appropriate for community-based action, whether that be your EPI profile, whether that be your gap analysis, whether you find pearls within your process evaluation, this can all be used in your identification of needs for your community and the direct action that you need. And capacity and shared experience, it gives groups resilience because these are painful processes often. And it's nice to actually be able to spend a moment so you're not either fighting or at loggerheads, to see that, okay, we're all humans. None of us are here for personal gain, usually. And that's important. And show what assets you have for the next battle. And I'm going to end with this. I come from San Jose State educationally, and San Jose State has adopted Howard Zinn, who is a historian. Really, he's a health educator, because his words sum up everything we believe in. And given that in the next week we will either have, depending on your side of the story, a great outcome, a not-so-great outcome. This quote is wonderful. I'm not going to read it because I don't have Howard Zinn's voice, and his words are powerful enough by himself. I want to thank you for this, and if I have 20 seconds for questions, I'll take them. If not...
Yes. Has there been any approach to expanding your toolkit beyond the church environment and for, you know, for a more lay environment versus the church focus environment? Has there been approach to or in terms of doing that?
The question was, has there been any moves to expand the toolkit beyond the church environment? And at this time, no. We've primarily focused on particularly the African-American church. And while our original toolkit was designed for an adult population, we're moving towards more tools that are targeted for our youth. What our leaders and the members keep telling us is we have to get this information to our youth, and we have to start the conversation, and these types of tools can really help us to do that.
Dealing with that, because you are talking about, because hers was on alcoholism, and so that then brings the, does your toolkit speak to alcoholism, youth, does it speak to issues around self-love, especially among our youth, as well as, I guess, the sense of feeling self-confidence, which can sometimes produce this kind of a peer pressure that makes people do not very intelligent things around sex.
Okay, so the question was around does the toolkit focus on self-love and youth? And we haven't got to that point yet. We're just finishing up this first phase of the toolkit. But our toolkit does strongly promote compassion and love in general. Again, it's really tailored for the church setting. And so many of our pastors and our leaders really use the biblical scriptures that are targeted about love and compassion and loving your brother like yourself and not alienating others. As much as possible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Come on, you're going to come up to the table and ask the question individually, so you might as well let others benefit from your wise question. You may have addressed this in your last class, but I can't recall. On one of the slides, you indicated which items in the toolkit the church had implemented most, which are like the brochures and the sermons. The HIV testing, often the HIV testing I saw was low.
Right.
Do you have a sense of how many people, you may have some
kind of evaluation,
how many people have went for HIV testing, spent the toolkit implemented in the church, although the testing wasn't offered at the church?
Right. Actually, what we're encouraging our churches to do is to facilitate HIV testing within the church setting. When we first designed the toolkit, we were really trying to just focus on education, and compassion and actually just mobilizing the churches. And we've more so now moved towards HIV testing as an outcome. And so what you saw on the slide was there were about four or five churches that have offered HIV testing events at their churches in collaboration with our AIDS service organizations. In some cases, we have lots of people show up to get tested. In other cases, there may only be one or two. And so in the next phase, we're also testing out some new strategies to not only have the testing events, but also to encourage more people to actually get tested and to really normalize getting tested. So we're not just trying to target those who may be most at risk, but to say that all of us are at risk. And so everybody get tested, whether you think you may be at risk or not. Sure. Because the testing events are done in collaboration with our AIDS service organizations, none of the churches do the testing events alone. We just really don't have the capacity or the skills or experience in the training within our churches to do that. The AIDS service organizations do all of the follow-up and track those folks very closely. And in Kansas City, we have a very tight-knit group of folks from the AIDS organizations and our faith-based organizations, and everybody pretty much stays in the loop and trying to offer support. So, but that primarily lies with the AIDS service organizations. And we really don't want to put the churches in that position as yet because they're, I mean, to be quite honest, really just aren't ready to take that on yet.
I guess what I'm saying is if you were the one that went to the church,
mm-hmm.
so you're encouraging members of the church
to protest
it. Right. What were your provision, not so much the church,
Right. again, it's our what we try to do as an organization, the Taking It to the Pews organization, is to make the connections between the churches and our AIDS service organizations. And we have occasions to do that through our quarterly meetings and through our annual conferences, so that what we want to be able to do is long-term, look at the sustainability of these projects, because we're not going to be in these churches forever. And so when we move out, we want to make sure that these churches are comfortable in working with the AIDS service organizations and that they can continue on their relationships. But again, for the most part, the burden of follow-up falls on the shoulders of the AIDS service organizations. But as needed, because many times people say, we can't go and talk to our own pastors. Can you recommend a pastor that I can talk to? And our pastors step up to the plate and provide that service.
I'm on a CPG in Washington, D.C. I've been on for several years, and your presentation was great, but it didn't express the frustration of the process. Maybe you don't have it in San Francisco.
Oh, please. No, I understand your question completely. And having done evaluation of this system for about 10, 11 years, I wouldn't say I share those concerns, but I have witnessed those concerns. Absolutely. That's one of the problems of any part, and part of that is being honest that, yes, this is a danger of the process. And in San Francisco, the first year of community planning, we did a retrospective survey, and the researchers left. They had never experienced an experience where they had to actually come to the table with community members and weren't just lorded over and accepted right off, and they left. And most of them have not come back to the process. Some of them have, and some of them have been extremely committed. But most of them didn't, because I think it wasn't their type of world, even though it was the world they should have been serving. Since that first year, and we have been doing ongoing process evaluation real time, and have experienced all of those things you just expressed, San Francisco is incredible in its ability, or the leadership, both of the council and through the Department of Public Health, has really been incredible in its understanding of these pressures and working with us, both as a Department of Public Health that has to interface with community members, as community members that have to interface with this often demonized Department of Public Health, on sort of understanding these concerns and making sure that the meetings actually are, if you're in a 3-hour meeting, there's no way that's not going to get tiring to some degree, but you can structure them and run them so they address the process, and so it does reflect PIR. I think a lot of the concerns are PIR is a great concept. It's difficult for people to really implement and stay true to, because there's often a rush. One of the problems is the prevention community planning process has an annual contract cycle with the departments. So right from the start, there's sort of a problem there. You're forcing people under the gun. Frankly, I would say it should be a multi-year planning process with those contracts with the CDC, would take some of the pressure off of those meetings to make sure everybody's getting there, either their research presented, their community's problems presented, anything. But no, absolutely, that's where process evaluation, if you're working on it, in prevention community planning for HIV or any kind of coalition, is important. And it doesn't have to be expensive. You can do it for nothing. You can do it for $5,000. If you want to spend a lot of money, like San Francisco, you can go anywhere from $25,000 to $60,000 a year. But the point is, it can be done, and it's actually worthwhile in addressing those problems.
So what about the orientation as far as getting people up to speed on what we're doing? Because everyone comes in with a lot of energy and want to work on prevention.
Right.
But getting to the point where they understand?
There originally wasn't very much orientation of new members and continuing members. Well, but again, but it's not just new members too. It's ongoing members, because the science changes and the data changes, and so it's really For people who are on a council for, and in San Francisco we have, if you want to stay on forever, you can. If you've been on that for 6 years, you may need some reorientation and to break down your understanding. We have worked with them, and so there's an ongoing orientation process. So it's not just 1 2-hour meeting where you're expected to become an expert in EPI, program planning, evaluation. It's really a multi-stage process to make sure people do that. Even to the point of forming some mentorship with older members and newer members, you know, that's often given lip service. As some were doing this, if you actually do it, it goes a long way. I understand completely, but it's a problem with the inherent, I think, of the system. It's how you address that.
Well, that's all right. But I was going to add to kind of reinforce what you said and also reinforce her concern, because we had the same issue in Tennessee a while back. But I think that what San Francisco has done and done well is documenting process. And that's critical in all prevention programs. Sometimes we are looking ahead to outcomes, but without process being documented and being looked at, then we are headed towards failure, quote unquote. And I think their documentation of process is very critical, and it will also allow us to look at where the weaknesses are, so that we can make changes every year, address those weaknesses, and then move forward. But that San Francisco project is.
Sorry, I don't mean to cut off this wonderful discussion, but we are a little bit beyond our time. I just wanted to ask you all to join me in thanking our speakers one more time.
Thank you all. That was very. That was a nice, really? Nice surprise.
I can't talk about
I was like, I don't know where to go.
I don't know where to go.
Thank you.
Because
I'm
too low.
I find myself.
I guess I'm just so used to it. Like, I just realized, like, I was trying to, like, yeah. I'm
yeah. Yeah, yeah. I like to walk away from the podium, yeah, but you can't even walk away
no.
from.
And I
yeah.
didn't have
anywhere,
like, and I tend to ramble, so I like to watch things. And so I'm like, oh my gosh, if I don't listen,
I've always wanted ADHA to go.
You know,
and my father was born there.
Kansas City will ever, you know, and probably the big concern is, do you have the venue to
right.
accommodate
to
all of us?
And the airport's kind of, it's hard to get in and out of. But it's
oh, well, no, Kansas City is one of the most easiest airports
really?
To get
Did
in and
they have
out
a safety cable hub years ago?
It used to have a Southwest hub, but not so much anymore, as, you know, most cities are really
right.
cutting down
Everything.
The number of
yeah.
flights. But it's a very easy city to get in and out of. It's a matter of the airport is so far away from the city. It's about a 30-minute drive into the city, and then having enough hotels, you know what I mean,
yeah.
to accommodate.
Same thing with it.
Yeah. But we, I mean, and having the convention center space to
right.
do it in. Yeah.
Morning, man.